Welcome to the Republican Professor Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Luke. We have at least one Richard A. Epstein fan on the podcast listenership. Thank you for your comment. I appreciate your encouragement to keep going with the 40th anniversary celebration of this book, Harvard University Press Takings: Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain by Richard A. Epstein, published in 1985, Harvard University Press. Go to Harvard University Press's catalog and throw some business their way. Get a copy of this, follow along, buy anything by Richard A. Epstein and/or Philip A. Hamburger. I think it's Philip Hamburger writes on con law. Admin law. What's the stick today? It's an Oliva Black Swan. I'm happy with it so far. Just lit it up. Got some bourbon today. It's a Dickel 8-year. They're not paid sponsors. I'm doing them a solid. They put out a good product. I share it with you. I mean, I had this other brew, and it's a local brewery. I'm not gonna say the name of it. But it felt like I was drinking like a Coke or something. I don't like soda, but it was like a stout. It was all right. It's okay. But I'm going a little bit light today on the podcast. As you can see, it's summertime here in the Southland, and I've got this towel over me because it is July, but I'm a little bit cold because I just got out of the pool. And the sun is setting, and so I poured myself a little Dickel, and I lit up an Oliva Black Swan. I like the texture on this stick, by the way. Yeah, I did a V cut, in case you want to know. If you don't care, you don't care. Okay, page 12. Philosophical preliminaries in Richard A. Epstein's Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain. This is constitutional law, and we're in Richard A. Epstein. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the publication, the wisdom of the publication of this book. Harvard University Press deserves some credit. Give them some, seriously, guys, throw some business their way. Get some hard copies of some books. Have them on your bookshelf. Philip Hamburger, Richard A. Epstein. Here we go with takings. You're going to love it. I'm on page 12. We stopped at the beginning of this paragraph at the top, the second point in Locke's argument. Locke wrote of the legislature as follows. First, he's quoting Locke. First, it is not nor can possibly be absolutely arbitrary over the lives and fortunes of the people. Why is he saying that? What's the point he's saying? Let me go back to something Richard said earlier. We're going to make a fair use of this, a transformative reading. We appreciate Harvard University Press making this material available to us. Thank you for Richard A. Epstein for writing it. It took a lot of labor to write it. He deserves a lot of credit. Harvard University Press deserves a lot of credit. The second point in Locke's argument is that the organization of the state does not require the surrender of all natural rights to the sovereign. What he means by the sovereign is the government. Another way of saying this is that the government isn't really the sovereign. People are. Go back to Locke's quotation here. Locke wrote of the legislature as follows. I'm right about here on page 12, if you're following along in a hard copy. Okay. This block quote in the middle. First, it is not nor can it possibly be arbitrary over the lives and fortunes of the people, for it being but the joint power of every member of society given up to that person or assembly, which is the legislator, it can be no more than those persons had in a state of nature before they entered into society and gave it up to the community. For nobody can transfer to another more power than he has in himself, and nobody has an absolute arbitrary power over himself, or any other to destroy his own life or to take away the life or property of another. In other words, there's a limit on, this is limited government. You put a bunch of people together and you call them Congress, it doesn't mean that they have no limitations on them from nature. As far as Locke's concerned, there are natural limits on government. This position forms, this is Epstein now, this position forms one of the pillars of the subsequent analysis in this book. As a first approximation, the rights of government are derived only from the individuals whom it represents in any given transaction. Nemo dot quod non habet. No man, no one can convey what he does not own is the analogous maxim of the common law. Incidentally, this is an interesting, Locke gives an interesting argument against the legislative power to delegate legislative power, which is not exactly the point he's making now, but it's very interesting when we get to admin law later. We talk about Chevron deference. We've talked about that quite a bit on this podcast. Working the Oliva today. All right. By Locke's view, the state itself does not furnish new or independent rights, qua sovereign, against persons subject to its control. There is no divine right of kings, which suspends the ordinary rules of right and obligation between individuals in a state of nature. The sovereign has no absolute power to generate rights. The state can acquire nothing by simple declaration of its will, but must justify its claim in terms of the rights of individuals whom it protects. Makes sense to me. Here's a quotation from Locke. A state, by ipse dixit, may not transform private property into public property without compensation. End quote. Actually, sorry, that was not from Locke. That was from Webb's Fabulous Pharmacies, a U.S. Supreme Court case in 1980. The private rights of, now we're on page 13, individual relationships are thereby preserved as much as possible even after the formation of civil society, modified only to secure the internal and external peace for which the political power is necessary. The Oliva is doing well. The sovereign is demystified. At every stage, he is required to justify his own assertion of power. Ooh, I like that. I like that. Talk dirty to me. Every transaction between the state and the individual can thus be understood as a transaction between private individuals, some of whom have the mantle of sovereignty, while others do not. That's Epstein's language there. Richard Epstein. Thank you, brother. Thank you for writing this. It's burning a little bit unevenly on this Oliva, but that might be my fault. I didn't maybe light it well enough. I think I'm looking at myself in the computer and while I light it. That's not necessarily the best way to do it. Let me... Oh, looks like I burned it a little bit. Poor Oliva. I actually felt sorry for this cigar a little bit. I don't think I've ever felt sorry for a cigar before. It's got this really pretty texture. It's pleasant to look at. It looks just rich. I mean, it looks like a leather chair or something that was handmade. It's a really beautiful cigar. I had one this past week. It was a Oliva 3 little thing. Really beautiful cigar. There's nothing like a good cigar. If you're not interested in cigars, I'm sorry, I'm wasting your time. But guys, it's the 249th year of the United States' existence. I'm celebrating, man. I'm celebrating last year. We really dodged a bullet. I think we need to take some time and just relax a little bit. Let loose. I'm not saying we need to get hedonistic or anything like that, but just chill out a little bit. I know I do. I need to. You guys see that I wear a tie like all the time on this podcast. I'm wearing a jacket and or a tie. I take it very seriously. I want you to take it seriously. If I dress like this every single time with this colorful beach towel over me, like I have right now, and my sunglasses on, and you know, I'm wearing, you know, shorts that are wet. Can you hear the waterfall? I feel like nobody would take this material seriously, and it deserves seriousness. Besides, I think Richard probably, when he wrote this, he was probably in a beach towel and swim trunks when he was on the typewriter. I'm sure that's how he was. A private analogy to the state's position clarifies the basic relation. The law of corporations is often called upon in analyzing transactions between a corporation and its individual shareholders, for example, a corporate buyback of shares, just as it is called upon in analyzing transaction between shareholders on their own account. The critical insight is that any transaction between a corporation and its shareholders must be disaggregated into a set of transactions between shareholders. No independent rights and duties attached to the corporate form. Of natural necessity, individuals bear rights and duties. Wow. Put that on a coffee mug. Put that on a t-shirt. Put that on a calendar. That's April. That's the April centerfold in Natural Right magazine. That quotation right there. Of natural necessity, page 13. Takings, private property and the power of eminent domain. Richard A. Epstein, Harvard University Press, 40 years ago, exactly 1985. Catch this quote again. Of natural necessity, individuals bear rights and duties. Those in control of the corporation, just like those in control of the government, can justify their actions only with reference to the rights they have acquired from the shareholders they represent. You know, there's quite a bit there about executive power. Yeah, the president is in charge. It's an individual. It's a different topic, but I'm just making a connection there. Groups, whether shareholders or citizens, are of course important within the theory, but at all points, the rights of groups depend upon the rights of their members. No group has a right which is more than the summation of its parts. Locke's second central contribution concerns the critical role of private property in the overall scheme of governance. Private property represents the sum of the goods that the individual gets to keep outside of the control of the state. By setting certain elements of value outside of public control, Locke provided an implicit answer to Hobbes's challenges by outlining a rule whereby the sovereign rule no longer generates monopoly profits. The state gets what it needs to rule, its costs, and nothing more. Whoa, there's a lot there. Nothing more. Wow. There's good footnotes here, but I'm not going to get into the footnotes because they get into the Supreme Court cases, and I don't think it's helpful to get into those in detail in a philosophical chapter, especially if you're not really... It's going to be a little jolting to go from philosophy to the Supreme Court, especially if you're not familiar with the cases. So I'm going to move on to page 14 and skip the footnote. The supreme power, this is Locke, cannot take away from any man any part of his property without his own consent. For the preservation of property being the end of government, and that for which men enter into society, it necessarily supposes and requires that the people should have property, without which they must be supposed to lose that by entering into society, which was the end for which they entered into it, too gross an absurdity for any man to own. Makes sense to me. Preach it, Brother Locke. Preach it. I'm on page 14. Here, this is Richard again. However, an important ambiguity emerges in Locke's account of government, specifically in his treatment of consent. The formation of the state cannot be accounted for by actual consent, as there are too many parties for any such contract ever to occur in fact. In modern terms, a set of pervasive market failures prevents the state's emergence by a set of actual contracts among natural persons. Locke himself was well aware of this obvious difficulty, which he sought to circumvent by appealing to the idea of tacit consent, that every man that hath any possession or enjoyment of any part of the dominions of any government doth thereby give his tacit consent, and is as far forth obliged to obedience to the laws of that government during such enjoyment as any one under it. I guess I didn't really pour that much bourbon. I might have to pour a little bit more. Seems like it's mostly water now. The ice cube melted. It's not really that hot out here, but the water felt great. There's a slight breeze, but that ice cube still melted entirely, which I guess that tells you where my body temperature is in relation to how warm it is actually. It is the summertime in Southern California. All right. Tacit consent. Locke's observation is in powerful tension with the theory of representative government set out above. If tacit consent is not real consent, then the theory of representational government cannot live up to its own billing, because the state must exercise power that it does not derive explicitly from the consent of the governed. Yet Locke never explained how any theory of limited government can escape reliance upon express consent. His account of tacit consent is defective because it rests upon a linguistic switch from the idea of consent, which may be implied in fact as from a course of conduct, to the idea of being bound because one receives in return the benefits of state protection. But the idea of return benefit means that tacit consent speaks less to a theory of contract and more to a theory of restitution for benefits conferred, or as lawyers say, of quasi-contract, which points out both the links to and the distance from ordinary contractual ideals. Nevertheless, Locke's view must place some limit on the sovereign's right to justify any exaction it imposes on the ground of tacit consent. Without that limitation, tacit consent becomes the thin edge of a wedge that grants legislators the lion's share of the surplus that Lockean institutions wish to keep out of their hands. This is good prose. Nice job, Richard. Page 15 at the top. Go to Harvard University Press, buy the book, or get it at your local bookstore. Support your brick and mortar bookstores. Seriously, I have a lot of respect for anybody who opens a bookstore. Used bookstores. I love used bookstores. Wow. I mean, just please do it for love, man. To quote the 77s, do it for love. Dickel's good bourbon. It needs a little bit of water, I think. A little bit. And then it chills out. It's good. It's good. I'm not really a bourbon guy, typically Irish whiskey. But Writer's Tears was way more expensive. I think it's the tariffs. Don't get me going on the tariffs, man. Page 15. To make the Lockean conception viable, it is necessary to abandon the idea of tacit consent as a source of contractual obligation. Tell us how you really feel, Richard. In its place belongs an explicit and rigorous theory of forced exchanges between the sovereign and the individual that can account both for the monopoly of force and for the preservation of liberty and property. The bulwark of the individual is no longer the absolute protection of his property. Now it is what, whenever any portion of it is taken from him, he must receive from the state, that is, from the persons who take it. By the way, if you get a letter in the mail from the IRS or any government agency, it's not signed by a person, bad. No more just random letters that are not signed, generated by some computer. No. The government is not computers. It's people. People need to be signing those suckers. I've gotten letters from, what's his first name? Becerra, the Attorney General of California. He didn't sign it. It's just his name typed. What kind of crap is that? But that's better. It's better than just some random letter from the IRS. It's not even signed by anybody. It's a computer. Excuse me, but does a computer go through the confirmation process in the Senate? Guys, seriously, it's these little things. You got, I know it sounds little. It's the little things. It's the little things you got to fight back on, because they're not little, they're big. They're big, especially with kids. Kids don't know any better, man. You have to train these kids. Take personal responsibility. It's personal responsibility. You don't want computers writing legislation for you or judicial decisions. Don't even get me started. Okay, I'm going to go back to the book. Now it is that whenever any portion of it is taken from him, he must receive from the state, that is, from the persons who take it, some equivalent or greater benefit as a part of the same transaction. The categorical command that property shall not be taken without tacit consent must therefore be rewritten to provide that property may not be taken upon provision, that property may be taken upon provision of just compensation, which is exactly how it's written in the Constitution. But he's saying from Locke until the Constitution was written, that change needed to be made. Locke's move from the state of nature to civil society now incorporates two elements of the eminent domain equation. What individuals must give up is their right to use force. What they are given in exchange is a superior form of public protection. You 2A people, calm down. I'm with you. He's not great on 2A, but he did get the public carry Bruin stuff correct, at least, when I listened to him on that stuff. So he's a little bit squirrely on the 2A, but let's give him the benefit of the doubt here, because he's really good on this. I think push comes to shove. You have to understand, okay, Let me make a sociological point here. Richard A. Epstein is the James Parker Hall Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. Chicago is a bad gun place. He's not there anymore. He's got a senior lectureship there. He retired there, but now he's got some fancy schmancy one at NYU. Again, a bad gun place. So I think sometimes that gets, when you're in Chicago and New York, and then you spend some time at Hoover, which is a really bad part of California, I think it gets into his, he has to fight a little bit extra hard not to be a little bit crazy. But he says, let's read that part again. What individuals must give up is their right to use force. What they are given in exchange. Now, notice this language, though. They're given something in exchange, are they not? They're supposed to. What they're given in exchange is a superior form of public protection. Okay? But Otis McDonald, the plaintiff in McDonald versus Chicago, he didn't have that superior form of public protection. He wanted to be his own protector. Hence McDonald versus Chicago, 2010. The right to bear arms is an individual right applied to the states. I hope you're taking all of this in. Take it all in. There is no contract as such, only a network of forced exchanges designed to leave everyone better off than they were before. The public use language of the takings clause is also consistent with Locke's general conception. Locke defined political power as power that is to be exercised only for the public good, an expression he did not formally analyze in his writing. Nonetheless, his articulation of the public good issue was part of his effort to ensure that the surplus created by the formulation of a political union did not inure solely or even largely to the benefit of the discrete individuals vested with sovereign power. The contrast between takings for private and for public use implicit in the constitutional structure will be shown to have just that internal structure to guarantee a proportionate distribution of the gain among all of the parties from whom the government takes private property. Well, you definitely don't have that with the magazine ban. That's a taking. You definitely don't have that in terms of that would be small fry. What he's talking about. He's talking about taking houses and basically taking entire neighborhoods to make like a railroad or something like that. The public use language. Okay, so the police power limitation upon the eminent domain clause also fits. Okay. Again, I'm skipping the footnotes. The police power limitation upon the eminent domain clause also fits well into the Lockean scheme. You got to have a theory about the police power. I'm channeling my Randy Barnett here. I was listening to him one time years ago and heard him say, you have to have a theory about the police power. And I was like, gosh, I don't know if I have a theory that I've articulated of the police power. I never asked him to come on the podcast. I would love to, just to talk about the police power. But life got in the way. Maybe later. The central purpose, I'm on page 16 at the top. The central purpose of government is to maintain peace and order within the territory, so the prohibitions against taking private property could not be read to prevent the government from discharging the very mission that justifies its existence. If private parties have the right of self-defense, then the government must have like powers if it is to compensate private persons for their loss of natural rights. The end of the power and the means that might be used to achieve it accordingly have to be fitted into the basic scheme. And the elaborate 19th century accounts of the police power show how a coherent conception of sovereign power is critical to the overall structure of government. That's what he's trying to do here. I agree, Richard. So, and so far as what you've said, I agree with what you're saying. I have to admit, whenever I hear you talking about self-defense, I get a little bit, I get a little worried about what you're going to say. But insofar as what you just said, yeah. The Lockean system was dominant at the time when the Constitution was adopted. His theory of the state was adopted in Blackstone's commentaries, and the protection of property against its enemies was a central and recurrent feature of the political thought of the day. And he's got a footnote, Thomas Cooley. Yes, I've read Cooley. I've read about Cooley. There was a great, and he's got Charles Beard. He's got to cite these people, the crazy people. Holmes, he's got to cite the crazy people. Holmes was a Republican, though. Sad. Sad. Okay. Thomas Cooley. I recommend Thomas Cooley. I recommend Angus Manoosh. Is that his name? Crap. No, that's not his name. I'm sorry. Angus McClellan. Sorry. Angus McClellan, his dissertation on Thomas Cooley. 2020, Claremont. Look it up. It's available online. You can get it. I highly recommend that. I haven't read the whole thing. I've read about half of it. And I've talked to Angus on the phone about it. I asked him to come on the podcast, and he had stuff going on, so. So lock system is in Blackstone. It's in Cooley. I agree. I think Angus has shown that. Although protection of private property was a central objective of the original constitutional scheme, the Constitution was not one eminent domain clause writ large. Indeed, the most causal inspection, oh my gosh, I just pulled one of my students. The most casual inspection reveals that explicit protection of individual rights played only a small part of the original design, of which the eminent domain clause proper was not a part. The basic constitutional plan seeks to limit government by indirection. The first provisions define the separate branches of government. Congress is taken up in Article 1, the executive in Article 2, the judiciary in Article 3. Thereafter, it defines the mode of selection and the power of the officials entrusted with various powers. At every turn, the constitutional concern is with preventing the concentration of power in a few hands. The complex provisions on selecting public officials are designed to control the risks of popular sovereignty by making sure that the electorate cannot speak at once and with one voice. Page 17 at the top. I'm reading a footnote really quick on Lochner, just double checking. I've got some asterisks and stuff like that, notes. Yeah, I mean, Lochner and the police power. You want to get into the police power at some point. We've done at least one podcast on Lochner. Actually, a couple different ones, I think. I'll try to have Randy Mardnett on. If I can get Richard Epstein on the podcast, I would love to do that. He's pretty old now, and I mean, maybe he will. I'll think about it. This would be the year to do it, that's for sure. 40th anniversary. Senators are chosen for 6 years by the state legislature. This is the original plan. Members of the House of Representatives are more numerous and are selected every 2 years. The president serves for 4 years and is indirectly elected by the Electoral College, an institution created just for this purpose. Similarly, the jurisdictional limitation on federal power is a further effort to limit the power of the sovereign by ruling certain areas out of bounds to collective governance. Federal powers are not plenary, but enumerated. No, I mean, that's true. What he's saying is true, but it's not taken seriously anymore, unfortunately. That's not to say what he said isn't true. It is true. It should be taken seriously. The voters don't take it seriously. I'll tell you that. Unfortunately. But we're fighting back. And confined largely to matters of Lockean public good. The Army, the Navy, Post Office, and most open-ended commerce. The system of checks and balances or separation of powers. Checks and balances and separation of powers are not the same thing, but okay. Then makes it more difficult to exercise the powers granted to government. This idea was hinted at by Locke, who found reason to separate legislature from executive, but it received its most famous and influential articulation in Montesquieu's The Spirit of the Laws, which coined the phrase separation of powers and justified the doctrine. True. That's all true. Good job. By setting strength against strength, the system helped to guarantee the liberties of the individual. Yes, separation of powers is designed to protect individual liberty. That's the whole point. You're speaking my language. Nice job. Okay. I wrote a book about it, in case you want to check it out. It's 450 pages. Okay. By setting... So long as the temptation to abuse power exists, power must be divided in order to be checked. The Constitution then elaborates specific means to achieve that end. The president may veto legislation subject to congressional override. The judiciary is independent, subject to presidential nomination and Senate confirmation. Congress has the power to declare war, but the president is commander-in-chief, subject to the power of the purse and the Congress. Thus far, the Constitution does not speak a word of individual substantive protections. Within the original framework, the rich array of procedural and jurisdictional protections was expected to serve some substantive end. Of course. But I'll say this about the enumerated rights. Excuse me, the enumerated powers of Congress. Recording in progress. As soon as they put it's an enumerated power of Congress to do whatever's necessary and proper, Democrats, once they really took a careful look at that, they were like, we can do whatever the hell we want. I'm going to get a little bit more bourbon. I'll be right back. Okay. I got a little bit more bourbon, and I got it ready to go here. Where were we? How are you guys doing on this stuff? Leave a comment. Leave a thought. I'm going to light my cigar if you want to let me know. Still going. Let me know what your favorite cigar is, if you have one. All right, let's continue. Thus far, okay. Page 17. Substantive end. And that end was, of course, the protection of private property, of lives, liberties, and states that Locke considered the purpose of government. The procedural safeguards worked to guarantee, by indirection, that the government would not pass laws that encroached upon the property rights that government was designed to protect. The Constitution, Hamilton wrote, is itself, in every rational sense and to every useful purpose, a Bill of Rights. Yeah, but I get it. I mean, I agree. That's the purpose of it. For that generation, I agree. But that generation had slaves. It just goes to show you that, yeah, I mean, you can put the words in there. You can put the Second Amendment in there, but that's not a magic formula either. The slaves were still disarmed. Ultimately, the people have to be educated and formed in their souls as a guard against tyranny. And that's why we're doing this podcast. You can't expect the government to do it. There's lots you can do to keep the government accountable, but you can't just expect a text to protect you. Page 18. With this background, it is now possible to see how the Bill of Rights fits into the original constitutional scheme. The bill identifies the ends of government, the rights that the system of limited jurisdiction, indirect voting, separation of powers is designed to protect. Here, the brute fact of federalism complicates the application of political theory, for the Bill of Rights functioned originally as a limitation upon the federal government and not upon the power of the states, a point which was explicitly and correctly held by Justice Marshall for a unanimous court in Barron versus Baltimore. Correct o mundo. Whenever I say correct o mundo after mentioning a Supreme Court decision, you can guarantee I've read it at least once, probably twice or three times, and I have my own thoughts about it, and I'm saying correct. That's true. I didn't look at Wikipedia. I had the printout hard copy. I read the whole thing at least once, at least. Limitations upon the powers of the state. This is the birth of the Republican Party, by the way, because slavery was a big issue. The states were ignoring individual rights. The Republican Party was established to correct that. Okay? This is the Republican professor. I'm obligated. It's in my contract. I have to say that. Otherwise, I get fired, and I'm the one that has to fire myself. It's really awkward. Limitations upon the powers of the state have been answered in practice by incorporating specific protection for individuals against the state as well, including the eminent domain clause. Since this book is a mix of political and constitutional theory, I shall follow the present law and treat the clause as though it applies both to a state and federal action, which is consistent with the basic Lockean design, as is reflected by the inclusion of some version of the eminent domain clause in all state constitutions. I did not know that. That's my comment. I'm reading my comment. I did not know that. That's when I originally read this. And I originally read this Tuesday, 30 November 2021 at 11:57 a.m. by the Christmas tree. I make little notes to myself, and I tell you where I was, and I think you should do the same thing. Keep track of your thoughts. Keep track of the development of your theories. And take this stuff seriously. Chapter 3 is called The Integrity of the Constitutional Text. I'm excited, aren't you? Again, this is Takings, Private Property, and the Power of Eminent Domain by Richard A. Epstein, Harvard University Press. It's the 40th anniversary. It was published in 1985. It's 2025, years after Jesus. And we're celebrating 40th anniversary of this wonderful book. Harvard University Press deserves a lot of credit for publishing it. That was the right thing to do. Good job, guys. And go to Harvard University Press's catalog. Buy a hard copy of anything by Richard A. Epstein, anything by Philip Hamburger, who was a guest on this podcast. Today is 10 July 2025, years after Jesus. It's a Thursday in the Southland. The sun is officially setting. I'm having an oliva. This is a black swan. I usually don't like to bring race into things, so it's a swan. I don't see race. It's a swan. This cigar is a swan. I'm kidding. I'm being silly. Had a little bit of bourbon. It's the summertime. I'm having a little fun. And hoping you guys are well. Enjoy your summer, man. And guys, this is so great what happened last year. Let's keep it going. Let's move forward. Let's get the budget under control, man. Let's get the deficit under control, dude. Let's keep going, man. Let's make progress. We can do it, man. We can do this. Let's do it. Let's protect individual liberty. And let's give the next generation or two or three a fighting chance here. This wonderful experiment that God has given us. I've been your host today, the Republican Professor Podcast. I'll see you later.